Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross this Monday morning. And I am joined, as always, at this time by CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Good morning, Jill.
Good morning.
So I was reading your JillOnMoney.com blog, and you have a story today about the COVID recession. And it turns out that it was actually a pretty short recession, but as is with COVID, there are some long-term issues that we're going to have to deal with. First, can you set me up by explaining to me what exactly is a recession? I hear that all the time. I know it's bad, but that's about it.
Well, that's good to know that it's bad, because it is bad.
Right.
But it's a normal part of the economy. The economy moves in big cycles, the cycles that go down and then they go up. But instead of thinking of it as like a mark in time, just really think of like almost like a swirling wave up and down and up and down. And when we have expansions, when the economy is getting bigger, that's kind of the good times. And that happens more often than when things go down or contract. Now, a shorthand for a recession is that when you have two quarters in a row where the economy is shrinking. That's kind of what most people think of as a recession.
Okay.
But there's actually an official body that dates when the recessions in the United States begin and end. It's at the National Bureau of Economic Research, and they have declared that the COVID recession began in February 2020, and it lasted through April 2020, and it is the shortest recession on record, basically 2 months.
Wow.
That's it.
Okay.
And so it doesn't mean everything's all great. It just means that the shrinking stopped when we got to the end of April, and beginning in May of 2020, we then started building back.
So, okay. So that's why the recession was short, but why aren't we getting back to where we want to as quickly as we want to?
I think the unique nature of this recession is really casting quite a long shadow. And what I mean by that is that, you know, think about the fact that we've never in the history of the United States economy literally seen the entire growth of the economy stop, and we send everyone home and say, stop doing everything and be safe and we'll deal with it. And thankfully, Congress did come in and say, hey, we'll make sure we're paying you to be safe. But coming out of that is really kind of tough because there have been dislocations from the actual recession that are really still reverberating. So what do I mean by that? For example, yeah, the economy is back to its total size where we were before the pandemic, but we still have about 6.8 million fewer jobs than existed before then.
Okay, so the idea going into the federal relief and state relief, all the relief that was put out there to sort of curb this recession and hopefully build some momentum and self-sustain and get moving and get us back to where we are or where we want to be, is the idea that really did help? Let me ask that first. Did that do what it was intended to do?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I mean, I think that you cannot look at the rapid recovery without tipping your hat to the federal government and the Federal Reserve, because the quick action allowed people to stay solvent, and that quick action allowed the those folks to really say, I will be safe, I will stay home, and I'll do what's important to make sure that I can pay my bills. And so when you look at that, you have to say that again, that money that came out of Congress plus the Federal Reserve dropping interest rates really quickly, making sure that financial markets were functioning, especially in those early days where we were getting big sell-offs. Those actions together surely prevented a much worse, deeper recession.
What about unemployment? Because I know that maybe there are parts of the economy, like you're saying, that have sort of gotten back up, but that we're still dealing with millions and millions of people out of work.
Yeah, I mean, there's a real weird dislocation in the employment markets because, again, what's happened is that while people were out and receiving that federal assistance, they were reconsidering what their options were in the labor market. Mm-hmm. So when you really think about this, I know that there is some talk about, oh, well, you know, if the federal government didn't provide this extra assistance, there wouldn't be these problems. That's not exactly what happened. It's weird because in the states where they ended federal unemployment benefits early, there hasn't been a big difference between those who continued to keep those federal payments in place. So now, as we see those payments go down, we're hopeful that people will come back into the labor force, but it might mean that the labor force is distributed in a totally different way.
Right.
Let me give you an example of that. You know, there are a lot of people who will say, I'm not going back to work 5 days a week. I don't like it, and I have primary responsibility for my kids. I'm going to figure out a different way. Some of those people are starting businesses. We saw business formations go up by a record-breaking 6.7 million by in the 16 months since COVID started. And so if you think about that, so many people starting businesses in midst of a terrible once-in-a-generation pandemic, mm-hmm. what does that tell you? It tells you that maybe they had a side hustle. Maybe they figured out how to make money on the side. Maybe they are doing different kinds of contract work. Maybe they've incorporated because they figured out a way to make money amid this current cycle. So I think the labor market is going to see a real shakeout. And that's going to cast even longer shadow than anything else in the economy.
So let's talk about the people who may not have the wherewithal, the capital, the chutzpah to start their own thing. As these protections are starting to expire, a big one being the eviction moratorium that just ended this weekend. What about those people? What do you see there?
I think that this is there's like a real mismatch going on right now, which is, there's been federal rental assistance allocated by Congress, $45 billion worth. But it is apparently just a fraction of that being going into households. So the Treasury Department says $3 billion of the $45 billion has been distributed. So that's a problem because, as we know, there's I see different numbers anywhere between, let's call it 10 to 15 million people in the United States who are behind on their rent. And so what that means is that the landlords who are footing the bill, they owe about, I think there's $20 billion that's owed to landlords. That also is affecting landlords in different ways, right? If I'm a big, huge publicly traded company or a private equity company and I own lots of properties,
right.
I can swallow that.
Right.
But if I'm, you know, just Jill and Aaron, who are, you know, married couple, retired and counting on the income from our triple decker to
right.
float our retirement, that's a totally different question.
That is CBS business analyst Jill Schlesinger. Jill, always a pleasure to talk to you.
Great to talk to you. Thanks for having me.
This is Seattle's Morning News. There is another coffee study out. I know we've had a lot of these, but in this latest coffee study, coffee is associated with smaller brain size. So I figure we'd better call in the doctor.
Paging Dr. Cohen.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. And Dr. Cohen, every time we get a coffee study, the first thing you ask is, okay, is this legit? Were there enough people tested? Did they do it the right way? So this study we're talking about now, you feel it was done correctly?
Yeah, I mean, I think that the study itself is pretty well regarded. Certainly, you know, one of the professors at Harvard School of Public Health was quite complimentary of the study, and it was out of the UK, published online in Nutritional Neurosciences. It uses an existing database called the UK Biobank, and it has about 500,000 people in it. Without going into too much detail, they were able to find patients who had MRIs done as part of the study, and they had filled out questionnaires and answered a lot of information about their socioeconomic status or overall health, and in that list was their coffee consumption. The authors found, in looking at nearly 20,000 patients, was that the consumption of coffee had a U-shaped relationship, which meant that if you drank some coffee, it was good, but if you drank too much coffee, it was bad. So what they found was patients who consumed over 6 cups a day of coffee had a 37% higher risk of having a stroke and an increased risk of dementia. And this was associated with having a smaller brain or smaller brain volume on MRI. But they also found that consumption of coffee at lower levels, like 1, 2, or even 3 cups a day, was actually good for you. And actually, consumption of no coffee was bad for you, which supports what we've known in the past. So I think what we can take away from this type of a study is that, yes, it's good to have some coffee. It's not good to have none. And if you drink too much, it's not good for you. So in some ways, I don't think it's that surprising. It's just that this was the first ever scientific study that really correlated coffee consumption with effect on the brain and actual brain volume.
So has anybody suggested a mechanism that could explain why this is?
No, and they can't explain it, and they don't know exactly why that is. And so they actually compared it to tea consumption. The same did not hold up for tea consumption. So it's hard to necessarily correlate it to caffeine. However, the caffeine in tea is actually somewhat different than the caffeine that's in coffee. But nonetheless, they didn't want to relate it directly to caffeine consumption and rather felt it must be by some other mechanism. But they don't actually know what the mechanism is. Nobody's actually shown that the benefits of tea consumption go away, and this study didn't show it either. It may be that that's the case, but we don't know what that volume of tea is, just like we didn't actually know what the volume of coffee was until this particular study. I mean, there's always this notion that if some is good, more is better. But that's not often the case, actually. You know, people often do that with medicines. Well, if I take, or vitamins, if I take this much and it's good for me, then taking more is better. And usually that's not the case. Usually there are adverse effects when you get to some point. And, you know, I mean, I think we should keep in mind there are numerous studies that have shown the benefits of coffee consumption. And it's based on science. I mean, we know that it can improve your energy levels and actually make you perform better on intellectual tests. We know it can help you burn fat. We know that it can improve your physical performance. We know that it contains some important essential nutrients, riboflavin, manganese, potassium, niacin, things like that. We know it can lower your risk of type 2 diabetes. And interestingly, previous studies have shown that consumption of some coffee may actually protect you from Alzheimer's disease and dementia. So I think what this study is pointing out is that at lower levels, these beneficial effects actually hold up. But the notion that if some is good, more is better doesn't hold up, that if you consume too much, that you're actually increasing your risk of dementia and stroke and potentially some other health issues that weren't looked at in this particular study.
Okay, so if you're good at regulating your beverage intake and you're able to find that sweet spot, then coffee is your drink. If you can't regulate your beverage intake, you're probably better off with tea.
Yeah, I think that's probably a true point. I mean, they didn't actually address the combination of drinking some coffee, some tea. But the recommendations out of this study was, you know, if you're going to have coffee, you know, 3 or 4 cups a day is probably a good thing. But when you get to 5 or 6, you're heading in the wrong direction. And so, you know, it's an interesting notion. I can't say that we know for sure, but this study certainly didn't identify that as a problem. That say you consume 4 cups of coffee a day and 2 cups of tea, is that a problem? And I would suspect, and this is just speculation, but I would suspect that they would have found that in this particular study if that was the case, because they were pretty thorough in their questionnaires and of people's caffeine consumption, coffee consumption, and tea consumption. I guess the only issue would be, and again, the study doesn't address this, would be, was there enough patients in the study who consumed both coffee and tea that you could have drawn any sort of conclusions.
Dr. Gordon Cohen, MD. Thanks, Dr. Cohen.
Thanks, Dave.
Well, you have a little more than 24 hours to turn in that ballot for the August primary. And Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott is here with some of the latest polling for some big questions in Seattle.
Good morning, Aaron. Yes. And just a quick reminder for everybody, if you haven't turned those ballots in, again, you have till tomorrow at 8, because we've really only got about 14% of ballots returned right now, so kind of a low number. I think some people were expecting that to be a little higher, especially here in King County. But on to some polling. So once again, Seattle voters are being asked to choose from a large pool of candidates for an open Seattle mayor seat. A handful of candidates are considered competitive, with Bruce Harrell, Lorena Gonzalez, and Colleen Echohawk considered frontrunners. But on top of who voters want for mayor, Andrew Villeneuve with the Northwest Progressive Institute says they also had pollsters ask another question.
What policies do you want to see Seattle's next mayor implement to improve the health of the city? 68% said homelessness. 18% talked about reforming the police. So that could mean very different things. It could mean demilitarization, could mean changing the nature of policing, could mean defunding the police. It depended on who the respondent was. Another 17% just said crime and public safety. So in other words, they want something done about crime. They don't necessarily want the police reform. Then we had 13% talk about housing costs, rent control, making housing more attainable. That sort of ties into the homelessness issue as well. And then another 10% said they wanted the police to get more funding or for more officers to be deployed.
And he said under those numbers, their results found mental health was down there in like the single digits as far as people having that as a priority, but it all kind of ties into the overall homelessness situation. At the same time, they also asked people to weigh in on the charter amendment that was just approved for the November ballot that would put in city charter requirements for steps that the city has to take to address homelessness.
It is interesting that although most voters are undecided for mayor, for city attorney, and for city council, all four races, people don't have the same indecision when it comes to this charter amendment. 61% said in our poll they would vote yes to pass the charter amendment, while 23% said they would vote no to reject the charter amendment, and 16% were not sure. So that's a net lead of 37% for Compassion Seattle. Very interesting considering that, again, most voters in the top two survey were undecided about their choices in all four candidate elections. You had 32% of plurality undecided in the mayor's race. And then in the other three races, there were majorities of over 50% undecided in those races.
But again, only 16% undecided on that charter amendment, which I'll remind everybody would, among other things, require that the city immediately create 2,000 more shelter bed or places for people to be, to sleep and stay. And also that they put, I believe it's 12% of their general fund needs to be spent on homelessness. Doesn't lay out, though, you know, the financing of all of that, just that number needs to be out there. And there's really two, the Compassion Seattle folks is made up of the business interests in Seattle, as well as several of the folks who have been homeless advocates and providers for homelessness things that we do here in the city. But at the same time, the opposition is made up of homeless advocates and providers, right? So you have kind of like your Nicholsville and folks like that over on one side who are against, who say that this is basically a Trojan horse for sweeps, because it would require eventually that you keep encampments cleared, but not until all of the people are housed. And there's some disagreement over whether that's because that's what the Compassion Seattle people say that it's about. But there's some disagreement on the other side, obviously. So
Hannah,
it needs to be worked out.
How,
go ahead.
How often does a charter get amended?
It's not a very common thing. It's not common. It's up to the voters in order to do that. And I couldn't tell you the last time that it happened in Seattle. It's pretty rare.
Yeah. So this is clearly an enormous issue. Like you said, 68%. It was people's number one pick for what's important to them or what issues we need to work on. A distant second was police at 18. That's an incredible sort of statement, I think, about this issue. But you alluded to this. I don't know if you know any more about it. But somebody like candidate Colleen Echohawk said that one of her issues and why she decided to vote against the Compassion Amendment, which she was initially for, one of her main issues was a lack of funding. Is there any talk about where how we're going to pay for this thing that people very clearly see as something that needs to get done. But you know, do we want this to turn into another thing that we just throw money at a problem and it doesn't work out?
Well, the folks behind Compassion Seattle will tell you that there's enough money in the Seattle budget for them to take 12% of their existing general fund and put it towards this.
Okay.
Right now. That's what they said when I asked them when this initially dropped. Not everybody agrees with that. And honestly, you know, when there's a new mayor who comes in, and depending on what happens with our city council at large seats, the whole thing is going to be open for debate anyway. You're right. Going to have new fights over new budgets and all of that. There's things that the city pays for that many in town don't necessarily think that they should, or that don't have as high of a priority when it comes as homelessness does, right? Mm-hmm. 6 years, Aaron, 6 years since we declared an emergency homeless situation here. Right. And for the most part, not really much progress has been made. That's one thing I talked about with Andrew Villeneuve here, is that any progress that we've really seen on homelessness, visible progress, which is what, regardless of what anybody who is in the city or the county tells you they've done, the people want to see a visible difference. Mm-hmm. And any visible difference really came with the pandemic and some of the emergency steps that were taken to put people in hotels and things like that, where until then, what have we been doing the last 4 or 5 years? Bickering. Right. That's what most people think.
Right. Yeah. Right? I wouldn't disagree with that. As you talk to people, is there any sort of plan, or are they talking about what are we going to do about what I can only assume is going to be a new influx of people who, after, you know, the eviction moratoriums expire, we could potentially see quite a few more people lose their homes. Is any talk about that?
There's, a couple of things. One, the city of Seattle goes well beyond the protections that our state currently has in effect for any kind of eviction protections. It's nearly impossible to evict anybody in Seattle mm-hmm. right now, to be honest. And even our state protections are pretty solid. Aside from the governor's eviction moratorium, there's legislation that was passed in this last session that provides an extensive amount of help for anyone who is in general. This doesn't necessarily have to do with the pandemic. So a lot of help, a lot of helps through the courts, rental assistance programs. So really, our city and our state got well ahead of that in anticipation of this moment coming where the eviction moratorium was going to be gone. I think, you know, there was a lot of question as to whether the governor was going to even extend it the last time around. And the only reason he did was because there was kind of a lag in getting this federal dollars, this rental assistance to landlords and tenants that's been given. But there's a lag in the system to get it to the actual people who need it. So that's why he left it to September 30th. But right now, folks are in a much better place in this state than in many other states. So I don't know that we see the influx in homelessness, but there's certainly some concern about that. And that's why you're seeing a lot of talk about investments.
Let's fill out those ballots, everybody.
Yes.
Got less than 24 hours. That is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you so much, Hannah.
You bet.
Your daily dose of kindness now. It's sponsored by Heritage Homecraft. When a man's mom was diagnosed with terminal cancer last year, he was determined to make her final wish, a family trip to Egypt, come true. Well, now CBS's Steve Hartman has an update on his latest plan to make sure his mom's legacy lives on.
By his own admission, Dustin Vitale was a mama's boy.
Mom, you ready?
He cooked Gloria breakfast every morning.
That's my baby.
And thanked her for the privilege.
Thank you, Mom.
As we first reported back in March.
You're going to make me cry.
Because Dustin had such devotion. After his mom was diagnosed with terminal bladder cancer, he decided to try to take her on the trip she always dreamed of, to see the pyramids in Egypt. With the whole family. 14 people. Never mind that Dustin works as a middle school teacher in Philadelphia and could never afford the $10,000 to fly everyone. He thought he could raise the cheddar by selling cheesesteaks.
There was no way you were going to make enough money selling cheesesteaks out of your house.
Yeah, correct.
So given that, what was pushing you forward?
Just my mom, you know, just the love for my mom.
And so, with his love and her recipe, Dustin started making sandwiches. Sandwiches so big, no container could contain. He peddled them to friends and family.
Thank you. Thank you, man. I appreciate your support.
But those people must have told their friends and family, too. Because almost immediately, cars started double parking outside his house.
Get your mom to Egypt.
I'm trying, man.
Next, word spread on social media.
Oh, my God.
That's good.
And before he knew it, folks were lined up down the block. A food truck operator offered his services. And in just 6 weeks, Dustin raised all the money he needed and then some. $18,000.
The pharaoh was coming.
The trip was in May.
Oh, my.
The Egyptian government had seen our story and gave Gloria the Cleopatra treatment.
She repeated over and over that it was the best thing that she's ever done in her life.
Thank you.
And she died not long after you got back.
Yeah, came home and did hospice and passed.
Did the whole trip help you at all with the grieving?
Yes. We created so many new memories that will last forever.
And to make sure no one ever forgets her, Dustin wants to open a cheesesteak restaurant. He doesn't know where or when. He just knows the name. Gloria's. Steve Hartman, CBS News, on the road.
So cute. Love that. Love a cheesesteak story, too. You know I'm a Philly boy. Seattle's Morning News, Aaron Mason in for Dave Ross. Now, from the G and Ursula Show, weekdays, 9 to noon here on Cairo Radio, my former co-host, G. Scott. Good morning, G.
Good morning. Good morning, Brother Mace. What's the word today?
How you feeling?
Man, I can't complain. Right. I just got off the plane, got home at 12:45 this morning.
Okay.
No matter where you go, no matter where your trip, where your destination was, how excited you were during that vacation, there is nothing better. You hear me? Nothing better than getting back in your own bed. That feeling is fantastic.
Get home, slip on those Crocs.
No question. You know what? Since we're talking about flying and we're talking about airports and airplanes, I mean, you know, it's in the news, right? It's all in the news. Travel is crazy. There's a lot of people. They're telling you that you need to get to the airport early, which is true, by the way. There is a lot of folks that are at the airports and on these airplanes that are traveling because, let's be real, 18 months of not really doing anything.
People, I know, man.
People are out of here.
I haven't been since this whole thing started. I haven't flown.
There you go. But here's what I want to talk about. Because I know in the news we talk about like some of the nastiness that goes on the planes and the reckless folks. I want to give the opposite of that. I'm going to tell you what I have seen recently traveling. I've seen some amazing people. And I've seen a lot of airplane etiquette that has been done the right way lately. Let me explain. No longer, or for some reason, I know we made fun of, the news has made fun of people that when the plane lands, everybody stands up.
Folks
aren't standing anymore.
Really?
Yeah.
Oh, that was a huge pet peeve of mine. I'm like, where are you going?
I've noticed that on the planes, like, people are really nice, right? Excuse me.
Good.
Thank you. Last night, it was a lady that was trying to get her her bags in the overhead bin, and a gentleman helped her. Loved seeing that.
Love that.
I'm even noticing that this is where it gets good. When you're sitting down. Now, there's some rules, some unwritten rules that I know the flight attendants, they don't say. They should. For an example, now the flight attendant, they tell you about the seatbelt and the buckle and the oxygen mask and all of those things if something should happen in the air. Let me tell you what they need to talk about. Okay, sir, ma'am, if you're sitting in that row.
I know where you're going.
Here are the rules. If you're sitting next to the window, that's your window.
Yep.
You get to decide if the shade is up or down. That's on you.
That's right.
Also, the armrest, you get the armrest by the window. That's it.
Yes.
Now, those in the middle, if you're sitting in the middle, sir, ma'am, you get both armrests.
Yes.
Those are both of yours.
Yes.
Now, if you are on the aisle seat, you get the left armrest. Period.
That's it.
That kind of thing needs to be talked about.
I agree 100% with you.
Now, let me see if you agree with this. Sir, ma'am, I know that there's a little button that makes you want to lean your seat back.
Yeah, here we go.
Do not lean it back. Do not. No, no, no. That is our mistake. It is the airplane manufacturer's mistake for even allowing that to be. You don't understand that the person behind you has now their TV, their tray in their chest. Sir, ma'am, please do not lean that back.
All right, look, I'll give you like 80% agree. Because for me, it's a lot of, you know, my family's on the East Coast. So if I do travel to see my family, it's generally a red eye flight. Right.
Okay.
And I'm not somebody who hits that button and goes all the way back, even though all the way is like 2.5 inches or something minuscule. But I will, if I need to try and sleep on that plane, just giving it an inch, just a little nudge, tells my brain, like, oh, now I'm in lay back, relax mode. I can somehow convince myself like I'm in a recliner of sorts. So I'm with you most of the way. But I do think that that in like long flights or flights where people have to sleep, I gotta lean that back just a little bit. I'm not trying to get in your business, but you know I have to. Oh, what is that squeal? You hear that, Jay? We lost him. We
that
lost
must have been
G.
the sound of G falling off a
he
cliff
got, yeah, yeah,
at that
he was
suggestion.
Like Wile E. Coyote.
That's See, what it sounded like.
He looked down. That's what you never do. You're fine if you don't look down. We've all learned this from the coyote.
He held
is he
up a
Wile E. Coyote?
That said,
yeah, that's
uh-oh.
Right. He is.
Yeah, hold
he
up
flew
a second.
On
yeah,
Acme
yikes.
Airlines. Yeah, yikes. That was it.
That was
and
it.
Here comes the boulder behind it.
The little
Bye,
puff
G.
of cloud.
Sorry, you went out this way.
Oh, bummer. Well, listen, we'll have G.
I'm glad I'm back. I think my
here he is.
I had technical difficulties. I think my machine it has jet lag right now.
Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, I mean, my machine right. has jet lag. It's kind of tripping a little bit.
Okay,
so I apologize.
Well, G, we only have a second, but I just want to ask you: is any of this? You know, we worked together basically when COVID started, and I can't help but notice that now, a year later. We're talking about the same stories, the same, you know, people not being able to see loved ones in hospitals, the Delta variant, like rates are going back up to how they were. Are you as frustrated about that as I am? And have you seen any change, you know, in the traveling that you've been doing?
My frustration is probably that of everyone else's. I mean, my frustration isn't like it used to be. With all of this, and let me just say this, I have a glass half full with this.
Sure.
Because if we want to go off history, right? History has showed us that the UK over there, Europe, usually has the bad stuff happen, and then we are 3 to 4 weeks behind. And so, what is happening right now? Their cases over there went up. But the death rates did not go crazy over there. And I am optimistic that that will happen here. Yes, cases are going up. I have two friends right now that are both vaccinated that have COVID, right? And so, yes, we are knowing that this Delta variant is ravaging through.
Mm-hmm.
Hopefully, right? Glass half full. Hopefully that this does not result in the amount of deaths that it did a year ago.
That is G. Scott. Thank you, G. Well, there's good news and bad news on the coronavirus here in Washington. So here with the latest on the pandemic is Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Good morning, Hannah.
Good morning, Aaron. Yes, there is good news and bad news. And really on the national level, as far as COVID goes, the good news is that vaccination rates are going up, and especially in some of those areas where there's been some vaccine hesitancy. The bad news, of course, is that coronavirus cases are also going up at the same time. So that's really something that hasn't been seen before in the pandemic, and officials are warning that those cases are going to continue to go up, especially in those areas, or unless we get high levels of vaccinations, even better than some of what they're seeing now in some of those areas, because it's still, you know, I think in some states there was 30% vaccination rate or something along those lines. The global picture is also a concern. We got this update from the Institute for Health Metrics and Evaluations, Dr. Christopher Murray, last Friday, and he says the global picture is concerning, especially where they still don't have enough vaccine.
In the absence of getting redistribution of vaccination, you know, the main strategies to manage the epidemic are going to be the mainstays that we've had throughout the pandemic, which is promoting mask use. Fortunately, U.S. CDC has changed their guidance in the U.S. This may have some influence in other countries of getting the vaccinated to wear masks. That's going to help put the brakes on transmission. But in the places with really large surges and relatively low vaccination, some of the stronger social distancing mandates may be needed to keep the death toll from being really large.
So I want to reiterate, he's talking there about outside the global picture, not so much the United States picture yet. And you can't, you know, there are some states where we've seen the Texas governor who said you can't, forbidden the mask mandates and things like that. IHME's modeling says the best way there's going to be in the U.S. 2,000 more deaths a day come November unless we get these numbers down, and the best way to do that is by mask mandates and or having everybody go to universal masking like we had seen before, at least close to it. And that's not really what we're seeing right now. As far as the global numbers go,
most of 2020, we had about 5 million infections a day. We had a period in April when the huge outbreak in India brought the number of global infections up over 10 million a day. We're now settling into about 6 million infections a day. So COVID is now worse than it was in 2020 on average at the global level in terms of infections. It is certainly not over, and we suspect that it will be a challenge for the world and for most countries for the next year or quite a bit farther.
So that's disappointing, quite a bit farther out that COVID will be a concern.
Yeah.
I was disappointed to hear that myself.
Yeah. Yeah, me too. I think the only good news, and I put good in quotes because it's the result of infections and deaths and hospitalizations, but it seems like vaccine rates are up across the country in places where they were low. I'm talking about southern states and places where now they are dealing with, like Florida, it's something like 6.5% of our population, but 20-something percent of COVID cases. That is... I don't know what we're going to do besides go back to the things that I just mentioned with G when he was on earlier. I feel I'm getting deja vu, because last year I was talking about the same things. We were covering the same stories, the same kinds of reports, and it's super, super frustrating. But now we're dealing with a variant that is multiple times more contagious than the original COVID-19. And so what are you hearing? What are you seeing? What do you think, if you had to prognosticate a little bit about what the future of Washington and COVID is?
I think I hope that we do well here. We've got a nice vaccination rate here. And I would like to say that there's not going to be any more lockdowns or some of those more extreme things like that we saw in the beginning that really hurt our economy. Mm-hmm. I will give you this offer. This is what the governor said when he was asked about that just last week.
There's just not a lot of money in speculating about what might happen. I'll tell you this, though. I do not want to shut down a single business in the state of Washington.
So that's positive, and that's a different kind of, from back at the beginning when I was covering COVID and what, you know, people would ask me, what do we expect from the governor? We was doing kind of like daily briefings. That's a different tone. You know, it sounds hopeful to me.
Yeah.
But I think there's a lot of concern. I've also talked to a lot of medical people in our state. The head of the State Medical Association and I spoke last week. The concern is that there's no mask, not as much mask use as we had been having among people. And last year, we didn't really have any flu. In fact, as an ER doc, he did not diagnose one flu case last year.
Right.
Because everybody was wearing masks. That's what gets the credit. Well, this year, that's not the situation. And the concern is that we'll have the flu cases that also come at the same time as the COVID. Because remember, all of this, when it comes to shutting everything down and stopping the spread, is largely to do with making sure we don't overrun our hospital systems and that we have the capacity, right?
Right.
So that's a concern. The other concern, and I've not seen this here yet, but multiple states, I think it's 10 states today, are saying something about something called RSV. It's a respiratory illness that kids get. And there, I think states, Texas, Louisiana, Oklahoma, and some other states, Florida, are seeing really incredible surging numbers of this disease that affects children and then requires them to be hospitalized. So, as well as COVID cases in kids at the same time. So there's a lot of concern about returning to school in the fall. I don't think we get out of this next, the rest of this year without some sort of limits of restrictions of some kind.
Yeah, I would agree with you. We talked to Dr. Jeff Duchin the other day when I filled in on the G and Ursula show, and he was saying, you know, it was Chris Reichdahl, superintendent of schools, and he was saying that if we don't mandate masks, or if we don't take care of our kids or vaccinations or whatever it may be, that you can expect your kids to every 6 to 8 weeks have to come back home because of some kind of an outbreak. And that makes me think of, you know, the governor not wanting to shut down any businesses, which I agree with. But then you've got business owners who, I mean, for me, one of my part-time jobs right now is some bartending. Mm-hmm. And I wear my mask. Sure. It's not everybody has to, although I think that has changed since I last had a shift. But there is something to be said, and I wonder if you've heard this from business owners, about when a mandate comes down, you don't have to bear the brunt of the responsibility as a business owner just trying to make your business work, that you can point to the angry customers you're going to get and say, look, we can't help. This is what the rule has been.
Right, yeah.
Have you heard that from business owners?
Oh, for sure. And absolutely. Especially when they first started to allow the reopenings and the rules were kind of funky and it was really put on the businesses. I think we even heard that from Mike Lewis, who owns a bar, our former colleague, that they didn't want that to be put on the business owners because that just puts them in a terrible position. They want a clear and defined rule, whether that be from L&I, governor, whatever it might be. And I think that's going to be crucial moving forward to see things like that.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott, the great Hannah Scott. So nice to talk with you.
You as well.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.